Hey, this is session 41, side one, recorded on May 28, 2007. And we're now going back to LaRouche, and we're two-thirds through LaRouche. We're on page 64 of my book, and LaRouche goes from page 4 to 82 on the left-hand side. So we're doing two-thirds into LaRouche, 64. We did LaRouche at the beginning, then we did McLuhan, then Thompson, then Croker, and we juxtaposed LaRouche with McLuhan and maybe some Thompson, but we stopped LaRouche at 64 to move more into, I guess, Thompson and then Croker. So now we've come back to LaRouche, and this quote that we're going to start with comes after a quote from 1984 in an essay by LaRouche called The Science of the Human Mind, A Treatise on Fundamentals. Now we're going to go back to almost 10 years earlier to an essay by Warren Hammerman, one of LaRouche's lieutenants, and it's from the Campaigner, January-February 1975, and it's The Self-Development of the Biosphere, that's the title, Self-Development of the Biosphere, and I quoted from this because it was a good essay, interesting, and it brings in some points that maybe LaRouche, I couldn't find the same thing said in LaRouche, not conveniently. So in that 1975 article, this is page 13. So, Scott, you want to start reading it?
All right. Over the past four centuries, reductionist natural science has been mobilized on the side of political reaction at each moment of revolutionary social upheaval. Thomas Hobbes in the 17th century against the English Revolution. Buffon et al. against the French Revolution in the 18th century. Malthus against the rising British proletariat in the first half of the 19th century. Darwin and social Darwinism.
No, and the social Darwinians.
Social Darwinians in the second half of the 19th century against the First International and the Paris Commune. German-Italian fascist science in the first half of the 20th century against the Russian Revolution and upsurge in the advanced sector. Rockefeller fostered, quote, zero population growth, unquote, in the last decade against the imminent potential for world revolution. In each instance of conjunctural crisis, the underlying terror that there is, quote, no way out, unquote, i.e., the absence of a conception of man's creative potential to determine, quote, progress, unquote, beyond the crisis point through scientific breakthroughs and social organization on a higher level, expresses itself in the political motif of, quote, every man for himself, unquote. Science, as it exists for the mind of the empiricist, the mind which denies its own coherency at such moments, exposes its underlying vicious ideological prejudices by, quote, coming out, unquote, of the laboratory, hyphen, onto the side of reaction.
Yeah, I remember why I include this quote, because this is so the lefty Marxist angle that LaRouche was taking when he was writing his Lynn Marcus. I don't know if he's Lynn LaRouche by 1975. Let's see. He's changed his name, gone back to his original name, Lynn LaRouche, after writing in the 60s and early 70s as Lynn Marcus.
Well, how does he spell Marcus?
M-A-R-C-U-S. And so it's, I have an article, Lynn LaRouche, 1974. So he has dropped the Marcus lefty line. I don't know, I don't think he's gone into the Platonic Aristotelian model that we've been talking about in excerpts from stuff written after 74, 75, but it's around 75 where he leaves New York and he ends up in Germany. I think in Wiesbaden for a year or so, and he's influenced by some people, maybe. Some say it was his wife-to-be, Helga Zepp-LaRouche. Helga Zepp's influence, her group of German thinkers, influenced him to look at the world historical battle between the oligarchs and Republicans, as between Aristotle on behalf of the oligarchs versus the Plato, the Platonic factions on behalf of republicanism. So that's later 70s. This is in 1975, and you have this Warren Hammerman writing the way LaRouche would kind of talk about it in the early 73, 74. I don't know, maybe before then. But it's sort of the line that he takes later. It's basically pro-technology, and those anti-technology are the evil guys on behalf of the oligarchs. And now we've done McLuhan. He doesn't look at pro or con on technology. He studies the effects in relation to other media and previous cultural alignments or formations. But here LaRouche is talking about basic power, bureaucratic power. So he's saying that in the 17th century, there's the English Revolution, which we know as the Cromwellian Puritan Revolution. That was an upsurge of positive creative forces, according to LaRouche, stopped by Thomas Hobbes, who apparently, I think, was Francis Bacon's secretary. So Thomas Hobbes is the guy who writes the concept of the Leviathan, or might makes right. Remember, we talked about that before?
Mm-hmm.
So in the 17th century, which is 1600s, Hobbes gives the oligarchs a conceptual framework to stop those that are working in labs. Remember, he says, prejudices by, quote, coming out of the laboratory. In other words, getting in the streets and stirring up demagoguery and mass movements of hysteria, and not sticking to the grindstone and making new technologies, new forms of energy in that. So the lab gang was stopped in the 1600s by Thomas Hobbes, stopped by Buffon and all during the French Revolution around people like Gauss and other scientists that set up the first national institutions before and during Napoleon's reign. So that's the French Revolution gang, and they're positive, and Buffon and those are oligarchic, anti-real science reactionaries. Then in the, so that's in the late 1700s. Then throughout the 1900s, well, the first half of the, excuse me, the 1800s, you have Malthus, Thomas Malthus, and he's the one that said that there wasn't enough food to go around, and that therefore social policy should be based on the fact that it's always inadequate supplies and survival of the fittest kind of stuff, even though that gets solidified in the second half of the 19th century by Darwin and the social Darwinians. The social Darwinians are extending Malthus's idea of survival of the fittest, not enough food to go around. Though LaRouche's science faction, Platonic faction, would say if we stuck in the lab and made new technologies, then we would find ways to feed everybody. So it's interesting that LaRouche, and maybe this is why the Pope and the Vatican like LaRouche, is that he puts down Darwin. He sees Darwin as someone concretizing the sensual part of man and making it come from the ape.
Yeah, but he probably doesn't support the creationist view of the Vatican either.
No. He, in the early 80s, LaRouche put down the televangelical fundamentalists as an extension of the same bad guys we're listing here, basically Gnostics, people who are just not interested in improving, don't see technologies as extensions of our senses and improvement of our sensuous development. So Darwin is an agent of the oligarchs in the second half of the 19th century against the spawn of Karl Marx and others, the First International and the Paris Commune, which took place about 1870, 1871.
You're saying Marx LaRouche sees Marx as one of the good guys?
Oh, yeah. That was in the late...
Marx was hardly Republican.
Ah, but LaRouche does a whole magazine campaigner issue in 1977, 78 called the Karl Marx, Benjamin Franklin, let's see, the Benjamin Franklin Karl Marx Never Knew, something like that. And he talks about how Karl Marx was trained by the Platonic factions lost his way a little later, but basically was a very progressive person. But that's LaRouche and his Socialist Party and leftist world of the late 60s, early 70s. And that's why I put this in. And this is an example of the way the kind of thinking LaRouche, as Lynn Marcus, would lay out. So, yeah, LaRouche didn't feel that by the 80s. He's talking about Marx as a dupe of the oligarchs who used the Bolshevik Revolution to carry on Thomas Hobbes, Buffon, Malthus, and Darwin, and Rockefeller, the later Rockefeller's agenda.
Mm-hmm.
But in the early 70s, he sees the Paris Commune, which was a protest, a strike in the city of Paris in around 1870-71, which got some momentum, like the May 68 rebellion in Paris.
What were they striking against?
The French had just been beaten in the Franco-Prussian War, so there was humiliation of the country. So the just like, you know, the Russian Revolution was due to humiliation, in a sense, of the Tsar's management of World War One. Of Russia's role in World War One, so the Paris Commune took advantage of that grievance in the French population and almost had a revolution, but it got suppressed pretty brutally. A lot of people killed. But LaRouche is saying, or at least Warren Hammerman, as an extension of LaRouche, is saying that was a progressive movement. And then he sees in the first half of the 20th century German and Italian fascists. Against the progressive zone, but there isn't much of a progressive zone when you read LaRouche's writings. There is sort of around the Soviet Union, but LaRouche sort of recants on that in the late 70s, early 80s, and says ever since Cantor, C-A-N-T-O-R, died around the turn of the century, he was like the last really good theoretical scientist, physical thinker, and that Einstein was okay for a while, but he blew it. And LaRouche is against Heisenberg. He later promotes Gödel, but he's against the Heisenberg and the quantum mechanics, and who else is there? Heisenberg and the other guy. Who did the principle of indetermination? Indeterminacy is Heisenberg.
No.
And then there's the other, forget his name. Anyways, LaRouche sees the first half of the 20th century as totally Aristotelian controlled, Bertrand Russell controlled, and a disaster. And then LaRouche sees himself as retrieving the best Platonic factions of the 19th century, coming from Gauss and then Riemann and Cantor and a few other people in there, not as well known. He sees himself as the retrieval of that tradition. So the second half of the 20th century is saved by LaRouche's updating of the Platonic faction, and he is against the Aristotelian-controlled Rockefeller, who is fostering zero population growth, you know, the idea that we don't have enough technology to deal with people, so we get a diminished population, which is an extension of the Malthus principle,
mm-hmm.
Right? Popularizes
the hidden agenda of the Illuminati, the zero population growth.
Yeah, if you believe those terms.
Right. I'm just saying it's being popularized that way.
Oh, it's being popularized as the Illuminati's agenda.
Right.
Right. Let's see. So then he says, in each instance of conjunctural crisis, so humans always have... because the oligarchic method always gets into troubles, because the development doesn't satisfy the needs of a growing population and a more complex society by the technologies that have been developed up to that point, because the oligarchic approach never can keep it going and is going to have a bust after a boom, there's always this conjunctural crisis, and that there's no way out, so desperate social measures are taken, including demagogic kind of revolutions. Like LaRouche says, the French Revolution was hijacked by the Jacobeans and the Reign of Terror, and that was set up by British intelligence. So even mass movements, LaRouche is a Platonic, quote, elitist, in that he's not for mass confusion. People may call him a a bourgeois in a sense, or middle class, stick to the laboratory work, to actual training of kids to be quote geniuses, rather than getting into ideas about utopia or mass communalism. So he says there comes this point where it looks like there's no way out, and because there's an absence of a rigorous conception of man's creative potential through technology to determine progress beyond the crisis point through scientific breakthroughs and social organization on a higher level, he's not against changing social organization, just it's like a practical version of the medium of the message. You bring in new technologies and that'll change the situation for social organization to the better. Mm-hmm. And so the oligarchs take advantage of the anarchy where the apparent anarchy or social turmoil where everybody is back to survival of the fittest or every man for himself, right?
Yeah.
Science as it exists for the mind of the empiricist, which is the Aristotelian, the mind which denies its own coherency, which he says was an extension of Kant's philosophy. Kant denied that the mind could understand itself, or at least its process. At those crisis points, at those moments, the Aristotelian science has exposed its underlying vicious ideological prejudices by dumping funding for laboratory work,
mm-hmm.
or at least support for the thinking that comes out of the library, out of the laboratory, and then on to the side, you get a period of reaction, period of reactionary budget cuts.
Mm-hmm.
So LaRouche sees that's what Rockefeller's doing in the late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Rockefeller Foundation. Oh, yeah, I remembered the other name I was trying to remember, Niels Bohr, B-A-B-O-H-R. Now, Niels Bohr and Heisenberg represented Bertrand Russell-controlled Aristotelian science, and Gödel and, I think, Schrödinger were good guys, and Gödel and Schrödinger were suppressed during the Copenhagen Conference in 1927. That was where the big battle lines were established, and that's where Einstein, I think he rejected quantum mechanics and fell back into trying to revitalize his theories in light of new knowledge that would come in the 30s and 40s. So Gödel and Schrödinger also were marginalized in that period. So LaRouche, you can see in his institute work in the last 10 years, you'll see him writing essays on Gödel and Schrödinger, fitting it into LaRouche's Platonic notions. There's also a couple of Russian scientists back then. He doesn't like, LaRouche doesn't like Teilhard de Chardin being credited for the noosphere. He sees that as the Aristotelian figurehead. He sees Vernadsky, V-E-R-N-A-D-S-K-Y, I think it is. Vernadsky was the guy who really came up with a Platonic Republican statement of the noosphere and is a more viable scientist in LaRouche's mind. And so you see LaRouche being an expert on Marxist history and socialist history and all that and the culture, he brings in those elements, even though he might not agree with how the Soviet Union turned out. He knows enough to bring in those scientists that the Western world didn't hear about during Stalin's reign and during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early 70s, his writings, he goes through a lot of factional history of the various lefty factions in European radical movements. It's very interesting. He did a book on Rosa Luxemburg, or one of his associates did, but he writes a long essay, an introduction to it. It gives an interesting history of all these people that regular Marxists and leftist historians talk about all the time. LaRouche was very well versed on those people. They may not agree with how he interprets them, but that's why LaRouche talks about the Russian Revolution and isn't a knee-jerk in relation to what was being developed in the Soviet Union in the 30s and 40s, some of the breakthroughs
mm-hmm.
that the West wouldn't have heard about. Do you know what was about? When Lewis got out of jail in 94, he was honored at the some Moscow Institute. There's a group of scientists over there that make a big deal out of LaRouche.
Mm-hmm.
So what were you going to say?
Do you know what it was about Heisenberg and Bohr that he didn't like?
I think LaRouche thought that the
uncertainty principle was just simply that as they got closer and closer to looking at the movement of the subatomic particles, they discovered that they couldn't precisely determine both the location and the velocity of the particle. So then they said, well, I guess it's indeterminate. We can determine one or the other, but not both. I think Bohr, if I remember correctly, was the one who noticed that when electrons would jump from one orbit to another, that they appeared not to travel the distance in between. They appeared to just blink out of one orbit and blink into the other orbit as though they vanished into the, sort of vanished from reality and then reappeared at a new location or something. But, and I'm not an expert, so I'm not sure I'm totally correct about that, but why do you think he doesn't like the quantum mechanics, he doesn't like those guys?
Well, I know exactly why, and this is where LaRouche becomes, quote, nutty, or most people think is nutty. He does not agree with the analysis that matter is made up of particles and waves and little bits.
Oh.
That's an extension of Aristotelian sensuality.
Uh-huh.
And that the... what is it that we're made up of? He says it's thought, but what is that? It's man's ability to conceptualize creates new situations, and the man should not get stuck in a model. And to say that we're made up of particles and electrons and atoms and waves and the wavicle, combination of the particle and the wave, and all these speculative concepts and descriptions of matter on a subatomic level, LaRouche says was erroneous, going in the wrong direction. He calls it the pairwise model, P-A-I-R, pairwise. So set things up into a pairwise dialectic is continuing the ancient tradition of Aristotelian dialectic, and he sees that Niels Bohr and Heisenberg and these failed scientists as continuing a tradition of 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
2,500 years. That's what's interesting.
I guess you'd probably throw Richard Feynman into that category too, I imagine.
Yeah, I don't. He puts down chaos theory. I don't think there's anything that's happened in the 20th century that most people are educated in the universities around in physics that he agrees with.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I was listening to. Told you I'm listening to a series of tapes on the history of science, and I was listening to a tape on Newton. And he was talking about how Newton calculated the movement of and position of the planets and their orbits and so on based on this concept of gravity. But then Newton actually admitted he didn't know what gravity was. And he admitted that what he was coming up with was a mathematical model that allowed you to make predictions, and it worked. It seemed to fit what observations. But in terms of what is a gravity, what is it, you know, is it a graviton? Is it some kind of a... an etheric substance? I don't know. Basically, I don't know what reality is. I just know that, you know, based on my observations and my mathematics, we can make these predictions.
Right. Now,
he was a bit of a... Now, Newton was also an alchemist and a bit of an occultist as well, too, so...
Yeah, all black marks against him from LaRouche's point of view. LaRouche says Newton was a fraud and stole his breakthroughs from Kepler.
He built on Kepler, and also he came up with calculus at the same time that Leibniz did.
Yeah, well, LaRouche says that Leibniz invented the calculus, and most people agree with that.
It's controversial. Not everybody agrees. A lot of people think that Leibniz saw Newton's work and then ripped off Newton, but, you know, I don't know if we'll ever get to the bottom of that.
Right. I checked it out with the Evergreens and you know, the medium, and talked to Leibniz and Newton, and they said, Leibniz got it.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, what the Evergreens said, is that it was good that Newton sort of adopted it, updated it, whatever he did technically, because he made it acceptable, because he already was a huge image.
Yeah.
Remember, information moved slower back then. It was a print society.
Right.
So you could have an icon for a long time, and no one would have believed it or known it if it wasn't a famous person like Newton promoting it.
And
so
you know, it was interesting.
There's a practical ground or the practical social dynamics of that time that we might not be aware of, that when we project our own understanding of the 20th century way of information exchange and project it back and miss the ground, you know what I mean, to use McLuhan's terms. What were you going to say?
Well, on the subject of information exchange, Newton's first theories had to do with theory of refraction of light and color, and he nailed that down pretty good, according to what science believes today. But when he presented his ideas to the whatever the Royal Society of Science or whatever that he was a member of, everybody tried to criticize him and tear him apart and accuse him of... He believed in the particle theory, which I know Newton didn't believe in, but, I mean, LaRouche doesn't like, but the particle theory of light, but he was opposed by people who believed in the wave theory of light. He became so bitter, so if people can't see what I see, forget it. I'm not even going to show them my work. For like 20 years, he remained basically silent and continued to work in private. And then it was in his later years that he released the Principia, I think it was called, which was a major, you know, a atom bomb blast for the world of science.
So LaRouche sees that as Newton being an agent for British oligarchy. And, you know, withholding stuff for 20 years, not out there in the streets, helping people learn new things and releasing information and not using it as a source of power. Remember, he became...
He was just bitter because of the... He felt that his character was being assassinated, and he didn't want to deal with what he saw as all the dumbasses out there who couldn't appreciate what he was doing.
Well, let's not get too distracted. Okay, there's a lot of argument over it, but I just want to say... We're dealing with LaRouche's view of it.
Right.
And LaRouche says that Newton proved he was an oligarch agent because he became Chancellor of the Chancellor of the Mint.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's called Chancellor of the Exchequer, something like that. I mean, he's the guy who printed money, just like Bacon did, controlled the money system in Britain. Bacon did in the 1600s.
But Bacon was the guy who edited Shakespeare. I mean, the guy wasn't a complete loss.
No, these people are smart, but it's LaRouche brings in the moral dimension. Who are you going to work for? Are you going to work for the present bureaucratic hierarchy, or are you going to work for the improvement in education and expansion of benefits of technology for all the people?
See, open question to me is whether or not, you know, the way that LaRouche says these guys are working for the oligarchy is though they're part of a secret scheme to undermine human growth and suppress human intelligence. You know, Darwin believed in his science, and so did other people. I don't think he was working for anybody. He was making observations.
Let me tell you this. You have to read a lot of LaRouche's research in the 80s and 90s, where they go into, he has a lot of his lieutenants do research. They go in and show the letters and the actual fighting that was going on behind the scenes.
Really?
It's interesting to read the ongoing battle in science, politically, and on intelligence levels, and then these people dig up a lot of source material that was uncovered in the last, 50 years. So it wasn't that simple. Now, the Everines, Newton through the Everines, justified his actions. He said, look, I represent the British, whatever they call themselves, England, I don't know. Yeah, maybe it was Britain by then. Britain is formed about 1717 or so, when they bring in Wales and Scotland. Before that, it's England, right? So in Britain now is England, Wales, and Scotland. Newton died, it was 1742. So as an agent of Britain, they would not release certain information or discoveries or makeups because they didn't want other countries to get the knowledge and make their cannons better. So there always was this paranoid war factor going on.
Right.
As these nations are starting to become competitive. And remember, the printing press is making these areas in Europe become fragmented nations.
But then to say, like, we're post-information, like that's a new thing that happened in the last 10 years is ridiculous. We were post-information back then.
No, it depends on what you mean by information. So
we'll deal
with that. Don't bring in me at this point. Listen, we'll do that later when we do the chart.
All right.
But let's stick with LaRouche since we haven't talked about him for 20 tapes. So let's just try to say what he says.
Okay.
Yeah. So the he documents how Leibniz is running around all over Europe, setting up schools, working with Catherine the Great, I think, in St. Petersburg and other parts, and creating these academies. Whereas what is Newton doing? He's sitting there back in the ivory tower, studying the Book of Revelations, the Book of Daniel, and monitoring the money on behalf of the empire, or the coming empire, not out there with the people, and hiding his research, ostensibly because he's piqued by nobody likes him.
Yeah.
So anyways, that we, I wanted to say that the battle between Newton and Leibniz carries through in LaRouche's perspective all the way up from 1700s to, you know, 1900s and into our century. And so the LaRouche is projecting a tradition that goes, that is the conceptual ground to all this factional fighting. And if one is not interested in this history, then what LaRouche does is not important to you. But the actual research into the battles, like people like Gauss and Ryman had, that shows in their letters with other competing factions, it is an interesting bunch of research and scholarship that LaRouche and them bring out. Now, maybe they distort, his team distorts the letters, but they actually find the letters and show the political battles, because remember, it was a slower time. It was a Gutenberg time, and it was important what is defined and what is the nature of reality. And LaRouche says the Newtonian Aristotelian tradition is speculative and into defining and classifying things and saying what is saying here's how
color. Well, it was into modeling. It was made models that you could build. You could build technology. You could fly to the moon on Newton's model of gravitational theory.
Well, you read LaRouche's stuff, and then it was the scientists that come after Newton, who were part of the suppressed faction, actually make the breakthroughs that lead to the possibility of going to the moon. That's another part of the history. They actually come up with the technology. But I was saying that the that Newton's discussion or discovery and modeling of how color and light work and how it's reflected in the eyeball and all that stuff, LaRouche saw that as speculative and Aristotelian as opposed to Leibniz and other people that were actually working with engineering technology.
Newton first was, you know, laying out the principles of refraction. He was working with prisms, and noticing how when you bent light, that the frequencies broke into the seven color spectrums, and if you put it through another spectrum, you could get them to merge back into light again. Nobody had ever really defined that or looked at it closely. So that was his first observation. You can't argue with that.
But no, how is that translated in technology? Maybe it is translated. But the interesting thing is LaRouche is talking about other scientists at the time of Newton. Can't remember the guy who dealt with the concatenating chain or something. Can't remember right now. And he talks about these several scientists at the time of Newton making technologies that will actually make better machinery. And those technologies got sabotaged, but eventually did surface over time. But when you get lost in thinking, what LaRouche calls Aristotelian science as Freemasonic speculative science. Now, I'm not saying that that's right, but I'm telling you what LaRouche says, because when we go into the next quotes, we'll see this develop. And so the speculative science is trying to figure out what matter is made up of, and whether it's particles or waves and that kind of stuff, is what McLuhan throws in the dustbin. So,
well, I'll tell you, you know, you learn a little bit about quantum mechanics. Maybe if you're actually, you know, a scientist working with one of those accelerators and doing atom smashing or whatever, that might be exciting, you know, but to read about it and, you know, okay, quirks and charms and, you know, and Heisenberg and atoms and all, well, that's interesting, you know, it sort of satisfies an intellectual curiosity for map making in your brain, but it's not satisfying experientially to even think about any of that stuff. You know, it seems
right,
to me
it's
that it seems to me if you're thinking about something that's deeply organic, that it ought to satisfy you in a deep way rather than leaving you feel sort of like, okay, so I got that idea down, but so what? I don't feel any better.
Yeah, but your standards for satisfaction are within the Aristotelian model. You're looking for an inner satisfaction. LaRue says the only way to get satisfaction is can you make an increased population from the technology that comes out of any speculation? It comes down to what he calls the human density potential.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's how you tell things are getting better and why you feel satisfied is that there's actually more productivity.
Yeah.
More people being fed and more people engaged in making better technologies. This is a collective effect, not in a personal psychological effect.
Right.
So let's go on to the next quote.
Okay. Before we move on, one thing I just want to say is that I think that my concept of the Platonic idea of the world is that it harks back to the idea of the Logos or the Word of God. The Word of God is a living word, and therefore it's an organic model of the universe, where the universe is kind of like an organism, you know, combination of holons that all add up to this huge holon or monad called the cosmos, which is a living thing.
Where'd you get the word holon from?
I came across that when I was reading Ken Wilber recently.
Oh, okay.
It was a cool word. But
that's the Platonic notion.
Yeah. And then the Aristotelian one is where now the universe is just, you know, it leads to the Descartes idea of that it's all blind energy and billiard balls, and it's just a bunch of parts, and you know, it's
just
not
your senses.
Yeah, but so I don't know if if we were to follow the thinking of Gauss and Riemann and Cantor and Leibniz, I wonder if they would be thinking in more organic terms, like, you know, the cosmos is like a living thing. And
yeah, well, that's what remember the title of the quote that we're reading from Warren Hammerman, the title of the article is The Self-Development of the Biosphere. The biosphere is a living thing. It develops itself through humans and through technology.
Right.
So Leibniz and them aren't speculating about the Logos, though they might do that in some parts of the writings. They're trying to make actual physical, technological environments for people to expand in.
Right.
So let me reread this. With all that in mind, I'll just reread the quote.
Okay.
And then we'll go on to the next one.
All right.
This is from the essay by Warren Hammerman. Let me spell that. That's Hammerman. Warren Hammerman. It's called The Self-Development of the Biosphere from January, February 1975. LaRouche's magazine called The Campaigner published it. Over the past four centuries, reductionists, that's reducing it to sensory facts and models that everybody sticks with and passes on as dogma, as opposed to Platonic conceptual transformations or improvements or development, whatever. Non-reductionist is Platonic, all right? So over the past four centuries, reductionist natural science has been mobilized on the side of political reaction at each moment of revolutionary social upheaval. Thomas Hobbes in the 17th century against the English Revolution. Buffon et al. Against the French Revolution in the 18th century. Malthus against the rising British proletariat in the first half of the 19th century. Darwin and the social Darwinians in the second half of the 19th century against the First International and the Paris Commune. German-Italian fascist science in the first half of the 20th century against the Russian Revolution and upsurge in the advanced sector. Rockefeller fostered zero population growth, in quotes, in the last decade, that would be the 60s, 65 to 75, against the imminent potential for world revolution. Yeah, LaRouche says everything started to go downhill by 67. So Rockefeller is ruining the evolution that technological advances that the moon program that JFK brought in, that was the last real progressive Republican Platonic movement from the 67 to 75 when we're reading this was written. Rockefeller fostered zero population growth, and that would include the ecology movement, which LaRouche didn't like. Rockefeller fostered zero population growth in the last decade as a reaction against the imminent potential for a world revolution. LaRouche goes on to say that people like Castro botched it too, that their world revolution models were inadequate. So LaRouche saw himself as the father of a world revolution, and he traveled around the world trying to organize something.
Did he like Kennedy?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He says Kennedy was a great breakthrough because it had the vision of going to the moon. So all kinds of technology spun off of that and in the program to make it possible by the end of the 60s.
LaRouche like Tesla?
I don't think he writes about him too much. I don't know.
Because in more modern, more contemporary terms, I can think of the split between the oligarchy and the Republicans as being like the split between Tesla and J.P. Morgan.
Right. Well, LaRouche definitely was down on Morgan's control of, like Rockefeller, control of think tanks and scientific conceptualization in the first half of the 20th century and even the last half of the 19th century.
Right.
So the quote carries on, in each instance of conjunctural crisis, the underlying terror that there is, quote, no way out, unquote, i.e. the absence of a conception of man's creative potential to determine progress, in quotes, progress, beyond the crisis point through scientific breakthroughs and social organization on a higher level. The underlying terror that there's no way out expresses itself in the political motif of, quote, every man for himself, unquote. Science as it exists for the mind of the empiricist, the bad guys, the mind which denies its own coherency at such moments exposes its underlying vicious ideological prejudices by, quote, coming out or leaving the laboratory onto the side of reaction.
Mm-hmm.
What he says in the first paragraph, political reaction,
mm-hmm.
reactionary stuff. So that's LaRouche in the mid-70s. Now, the next quote is... back to the essay.
Before we go to the next quote, I just want to say something.
Yeah.
Take this as being metaphorical because it's going to sound too wacky to for anybody to really want to put any credence in. But as a metaphor, I thought this was interesting. I was listening to this guy, Fred Allen Wolf, who's a contemporary physicist.
Yeah, a friend of Jack Zafady. I know him.
Yeah, and he's
the main scientist in What the Bleep Do We Know.
Yeah, through a series of coincidences, he ended up having some very powerful encounters with some shamans in Peru and like that. But he...
well, he started off in Paris with Sarfati in 1973 when they met an occultist, Carlos Suarez, I think his name was.
Uh-huh, yeah.
It's in Sarfati's book.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, he told this story about a particular... he was doing a review of some physicists who made breakthroughs in history, and this one particular physicist was complete genius, but very arrogant and condescending. But he was making these mathematical and conceptual breakthroughs in modern physics that were pretty astonishing. And then, but he couldn't work out, you know, like gravitational stuff, like Sarfati's interested in, like, you know, how do UFOs work and like that. And so apparently, I forget what his encounter was with, like some, through a medium or something like that, he encountered some being or creature and lives in some dimension that knew how, you know, UFOs work and how anti-gravity and all that stuff works. And this creature that was being channeled, or this person that was being channeled to this scientist said, you know, the scientist said, well, do you understand the breakthroughs I've made? He said, no. He said, your breakthroughs are way too complicated. I couldn't even begin to understand what you're doing, but what you're doing...
Oh, okay, I missed that. Who's saying what about whose science?
The
spirit is saying.
No, yeah, right. The scientist who made all these breakthroughs, and I forget his name, guy that Fred Allen Wolf was talking...
What was the spirit saying?
The spirit said... The guy wanted to know if the spirit understood his mathematics and his conceptual breakthroughs.
And the spirit said it didn't.
He said, no. He said, your stuff is way too complicated. I could never figure out what you're doing. But the fact of the matter is, what you're doing doesn't work on these higher levels anyway. It's what works on these higher levels is much more efficient, elegant, and easy to understand. So basically, you know, you're just making things way too complex, you know, and uninteresting. So that's what I'm saying. You know, the Darwin...
Okay, what's that got to do with Fred Wolf?
Well, Fred Wolf was telling the story, so I was just using him as an introduction to the story. And I'm using this as a metaphor. We look at Darwin, we look at Heisenberg, we look at these guys come up with these complex models that can bust your brains. You got to be a genius in mathematics to understand them. It doesn't mean you're smart. Because the real world may actually work on much simpler principles, where you don't have to be a Rubik's Cube genius to figure it out anyway, and doing that is just stupid.
Well, that's LaRouche's attitude. He says the scientist has to be political, and he has to kick the money changers out of the temple. What scientist today or in the world of grant grubbing would do that? Only LaRouche is out there trying to nationalize the Federal Reserve and claim to be a philosopher and scientist. But LaRouche would say, yeah, that's speculative, and you need to have the students retrace all the discoveries so that they find out where we came from and build on it, not accumulate speculative models. And basically, LaRouche didn't like algebra. Said we need to do geometry. And the simple principle that LaRouche says we're always spiraling around and developing is the principle of least resistance.
Mm.
So LaRouche would agree with you that it's not that complex, yet it requires a lot of work to come up with improvements on.
Right.
And define what is the technology that has the least friction.
Yeah, yeah. He's implying the movement towards cold fusion.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think we just got hardly any time left on this side, but I wanted to, you know, ask you why he thought he didn't like Kant. Kant was the guy that did the Critique of Pure Reason. I guess probably for the same reason he didn't like those other guys, but did he specifically say why he didn't like Kant?
Yeah, he says that Kant came to the point of saying that we couldn't understand the whole situation, mm-hmm. and we had to accept that, or he created a philosophy dealing with that dilemma. And LaRouche says, no, we can understand. That's why that little section there, the empiricist believes the mind denies its own coherency. And Kant was part of that problem.
Mm.
Maybe it was the